Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. One of the serious issues facing America, highlighted by the recent assassination of Turning Point USA founder Charlie Kirk, is left-wing indoctrination, which drives certain individuals to take that plunge into violent political activism. Charlie's shooter was allegedly from a MAGA-supporting family, but was radicalized into believing that Charlie was not a political activist whose trademark style was nonviolent conversation to convert or at least open the minds of his opponents, but a dangerous fascist who needed to be shut down by any means necessary. That indoctrination into the leftist worldview is most egregious and damaging in higher education, of course, and not just on woke Ivy League campuses like Harvard or UC Berkeley. Charlie was shot while speaking at a small red state school, and prior to that, a change.org petition had been circulating complaining that he was scheduled to speak at a couple of Utah colleges. The so-called tolerant, inclusive left cannot tolerate having their views challenged, and so left-wing activists smeared him as a hater and his message as hate speech in an effort to get him canceled. When that didn't work, one of their comrades decided to cancel Charlie permanently. This won't come as a shock to any conservatives out there, but with relatively few exceptions, our universities, from the Ivy League all the way to Utah Valley University, have been thoroughly captured by subversive educators and administrators whose mission is not to open minds and pass down the grand intellectual, artistic, and moral legacy of our civilization, but to radicalize our youth into ideology-blinkered, totalitarian activists with a ruthless lust for hegemonic power. The result is that our campuses are now, as my colleague Daniel Greenfield put it, training camps for terrorists and hotbeds of violent intolerance for any fellow Americans who don't subscribe to progressive orthodoxy. This must end. The radical left death grip on education must be ripped away and the subversives purged. The future of America, indeed the present of America, depends on it. And there are few authors and thinkers better to dive into that topic than my upcoming guest, who wrote a great piece for City Journal after Charlie's death about this murderous ideology that has permeated higher education in America. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we are having here. Don't touch that dial. If you're not reading everything you can find by my next guest here at the intersection of politics and culture, then you need to take a long, hard look in the mirror and ask what it is you are doing with your life, because you're missing out on some of the best written and most insightful cultural commentary around. She's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a contributing editor at City Journal, an award-winning journalist, and New York Times best-selling author of The War on Cops, The Diversity Delusion, and When Race Trumps Merit, all of which I've read and recommend highly. She was my very first guest on The Right Take, and this is her third appearance, I think, and only a couple of other guests have had that distinction. Heather McDonald, welcome back to The Right Take Podcast.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, and it's been too long, so I'm glad to be back on.
It has been too long, and I'm happy to have you back. We're having this conversation barely 2 weeks after the heinous murder of Charlie Kirk. I can't believe it's been that long already, but a lot has happened. The world has even changed, I think. And immediately, or pretty much immediately, in the wake of his shooting, you wrote a piece for City Journal, which I think is important to talk about. It's titled, "An Ideology Whose Logic Leads to Murder." What ideology are you referring to?
This is the ideology that to disagree with somebody is to target hatred towards that person. It's the ideology that dominates college campuses. It is connected to the other idea of safetyism, that there's a group of so-called marginalized students on college campuses. Basically, anybody who's not a heterosexual white male gets to count him or herself as marginalized, which is preposterous. There's no more privileged group of individuals in human history than all college students. But the campus left has used this idea of hate and hate speech as their primary tool for silencing dissent from campus orthodoxies. It's a solipsistic instinct. If somebody states as a general empirical proposition, "I believe that nations have the right to control their own borders," that that's an inherent aspect of sovereignty, you will be labeled a hater. And as such, you will be seen as causing harm to immigrants, to immigrant-adjacent people, and therefore you should be shut down. If you say, "I believe that biological sex is imprinted in every cell in our body, it's in our genetic code, it is determined biologically at the moment of conception, it is not assigned by whim, arbitrarily by the obstetrician when he takes a baby out of, you know, the mother's body," that no, you are inherently male or female, that will be seen as an act of hate, as hate speech, and you are a hater, even though you have said nothing about any particular individual. So the campus bureaucracies, the diversity bureaucracies, have been saying that this hate speech causes harm and therefore it must be silenced and haters must be excluded. It is no coincidence that Tyler Robinson, in his text messages to his gay transitioning lover, said that the reason that he was killing Charlie Kirk was because he had had enough of Kirk's hate, that some hate cannot be negotiated away. It is no accident that days before Kirk came to Utah Valley University, a student petition circulated, garnered thousands of signatures, saying Kirk should be kept off campus because he spreads hate. So this narcissistic, self-engrossed, melodramatic ideology of censorship is now proven you silence by any means necessary, and it has been taken up in the much wider culture.
Yeah, this weaponization of the word hate is really a genius strategy, isn't it?
Yep.
Because it just cuts straight through the kind of rational debate in which Charlie Kirk was engaging, and in which he was actually changing minds, or at least those minds that were open-minded enough to questioning one's own ideology and positions. He was very successful at doing that, but labeling him a hater and labeling his speech as hate immediately shuts down and demonizes and delegitimizes your political opponent, doesn't it? That's really a genius strategy.
Absolutely. It is genius, and it is infuriating, and it is just, it's an amazing sort of reflex of our current world. It's also worth pointing out that this is a novel pretext for censorship. Free speech is an aberration in all of human history. It's even been an aberration in the United States, but we're the closest country that's ever come to realizing the ideal of free speech. But traditionally, it's been rulers who are terrified about any challenge to their authority. So if you criticized a regime, if you satirized a ruler or the priesthood or the church, you were viewed as seditious, as a threat to stability, and your views should not circulate because they would foment revolution. That's kind of, I disagree with it, but that's a rationale that I would respect. This hate idea is so completely ludicrous, as you say. It strikes at the very possibility of rational discourse because it immediately introduces a subjective emotional element into discourse. And it's, again, the safetyism, the idea that I am harmed by this. I mean, this is where we got, it wasn't so long ago when we were noticing for the first time the trigger warnings, another aspect of the narcissistic, feminized, safetyist campus that above all females were so vulnerable and so delicate that they couldn't read Ovid's Metamorphoses because a lot of the stories are about, you know, sexual predation, but with an extraordinarily gorgeous and profound vision of the constant transformation of the world. One of the great works of literature, but we couldn't read Metamorphoses because we were so fragile and it would traumatize us to merely read about, you know, the rape of Europa, Jove taking the form of a bull, a gorgeous white bull to carry off Europa. So it's such a pathetic turn in the history of censorship, I have to say.
Yeah, and the safetyism, as you call it, the aim all along was really not to protect students from harm, but to indoctrinate them into believing that their opponent's free speech is just a tool for fascism.
Yeah.
And therefore must be shut down, as you mentioned, by any means necessary. Again, that's a really genius strategy, but it's intentional. Does it really stem, if you go far enough back, to Marx's perspective, Marx's worldview, that everything can be reduced to power plays, that everything is about the oppressor versus the oppressed? And when you identify everything, every human interaction that way, and everything in the world stems from that kind of worldview, that's what leads to this attitude that's dominating campuses, doesn't it?
Well, first of all, I would say that it's one of the purposes of safetyism is also to indoctrinate people into victimhood and the belief that they're passive, they're helpless, they need help. That is the quintessential stance for the modern welfare state, that we're not a nation of hardy yeomen, entrepreneur pioneers. We're all dependent on government services. Children need government to eat lunch. They need government to eat breakfast because mothers are deemed incapable of preparing breakfast, even though you can prepare healthy breakfast for children for pennies a day at most. And yet we're all supposed to be dependent on an ever greater welfare state and the NGOs who are its satellites and its crusaders. As far as the Marxist idea, I know that is a very prevalent explanation for much of our world among conservatives whom I respect completely, like yourself, Mark. And you know, the idea is, well, there's Marxism, and then cultural Marxism is the phrase we use for the current things, and that's just another version of Marxism. I don't know. I'm not sure what the value is of that rhetorical move. Part of me thinks cynically that for people, it's viewed as a way of interesting people who are not following these debates, but they can respond to communism, they can respond to Marx. And so if you tell them, oh, this is really Marxist, they'll say, whoa, I better pay attention to what's going on in the universities. Otherwise, they would have been tempted to just say, oh, these silly snowflakes, I'm going to laugh them off, it doesn't matter. To me, I find Marxism, the real thing, far more interesting, far more historically grounded. Marx had some valid observations, I think, about the rise of the proletarian, what the radical novelty of a free market capitalist system of exchange. And the categories he was working with of workers and capitalists and owners, those are real categories and they're interesting ones in history. What we've got now is so petty, so trivial. Again, I come back to the phrase solipsism or narcissism, the whole identity politics stuff.
Yeah.
Marx, I can't think, would have been particularly interested in the 136 varieties of gender queerness, you know. So I think our maladies, they're the maladies of affluence. They're the maladies of having so much and taking so much for granted, and the elevation of victimhood, whether that comes from a Marxist perspective, whether it's a long deferred result of the Christian reversal of traditional classical values that valued strength and heroism And Christianity turned that on its head and said, we have no interest in wealth. We think the wealthy are potentially oppressors themselves. We value the victims. I don't know. So I'd rather sort of look at our current situation as a product of a Western decadence as opposed to the long arm of Marxism.
Interesting. One of the aspects of Charlie's murder that many have found disturbing and unexpected is that it didn't happen at UC Berkeley or some woke Ivy League campus. It happened at this small red state university, which kind of demonstrates that this ideology that you've described has spread its tentacles everywhere. How did this safetyism, this kind of totalitarian safetyism, spread so thoroughly, not only throughout the more elite universities, but to non-elite campuses as well? Was it mostly through DEI policies or academic programs like women's studies departments or indoctrination into critical race theory? Was any or all of those things?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, and if you look at these videos of the teachers, the K through 12, there was a woman from Alabama who filmed herself. She's a K through 12 teacher, and she was so proud of her response to her daughters telling her about Charlie Kirk's assassination that she recreated it and filmed herself in a TikTok video giving her reactions and celebrating this and saying, you know, I hope it was painful because this guy is, you know, given us so much, pardon my language, bullshit. We need this right now. I hope it was traumatic and I hope he suffered the way that we're suffering because of the bigoted bullshit he spoke. This is her words, not mine. It's everywhere. It is absolutely everywhere. And the roots that it uses is absolutely the diversity bureaucracies in universities. The teacher ed schools have been complete disasters for decades. I wrote a major piece in the 1990s about the flagship teacher ed schools in New York City, Bank Street, Columbia, Hunter College. And I should need to say this because it was already obvious. Back then, they were already promoting the ideas of victimhood and multiculturalism and anti-Western civilization, anti-whiteness. And so all these public school teachers, ed school is 2 years of marination in anti-white hatred. And we need to get rid of the idea that you have to have an ed school credential to teach in a public school. The most fancy, expensive, you know, $70,000 a year tuition private schools do not have an ed school credentialing requirement. We sure as hell need to get our kids out of K through 12. Homeschooling needs to be exponentially increased. The classical education movement needs to be exponentially increased. We need these kids need to be airlifted out right now. And as far as the universities, it's very hard to start new institutions, but they are going to, despite what Trump is doing and most of what he's doing in universities, I applaud completely, the faculty are still there and they're still going to be turning out these bearers of the anti-Western virus that are going to go and continue to infect our universities. Now, with regards to Utah Valley University, if I were them, I would say, wait a minute, don't blame us. You know, this was somebody who came from outside. We did have the student petition that was combined from UVA, UVU, and Utah State University. And the president of the University of Utah Valley denied the petition and said, no, he's going to speak. That having been said, I did poke around their academic listings. And to your point, it doesn't have an official gender studies and black studies, women's studies department, but it does. It has honored people from other Utah schools. A woman from a Utah school came and gave a keynote address and was lauded by the school, who was just an absolute perfect embodiment of the Latina, gay, intersectional, professional victim type. And they have people within their communications department who also conform to the norm that some people were lulled into believing only exists on Ivy League campuses. So it's the bureaucracies, the student service bureaucracies. The more you look, it is just stunning how pervasive it is.
Yes, and as you alluded to earlier, it's not just a campus phenomenon any longer. It's really deeply, I think, permeated society at large. I'm reminded of a video that I saw earlier this month of a Black woman, Black Lives Matter spokesperson, I think, or affiliate, speaking about the ghastly murder of that Ukrainian girl, Irina Zarutska, on a Charlotte train. The spokeswoman said, quote, "All oppressed people have a right to violence," unquote, suggesting that, you know, the so-called marginalized individuals like Irina's murderer, who is Black, are justified, if not actually righteous, in waging violence as a tool against this so-called oppression. What are the ramifications for society if this insane perspective becomes even more normalized than it already has been?
Well, there is no civilization when that's possible. Civilization was created when people decided, I was going to say that the ceding of the power of individual vengeance and retribution to the state in exchange for security, that I'm going to revise that because the nation state is relatively recent in human history. But if individuals feel like they are entitled to go around committing murder without due process, without the individual being charged with anything, without being able to make a defense, that some people arrogate to themselves the power of prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner, then we're in sheer civil war. I mean, then everybody better damn well be armed, and you don't know where the next hit is coming from, and everything stops at that point, because civilization does depend on civil peace. You need to be able to know that you can go about creating a livelihood, creating a business, accumulating property, accumulating wealth, without having to ride shotgun all the time, that it's going to be stolen or that you're going to be killed. But, you know, this is not, it's not fanciful. We have to take these ideologies seriously. And the ideology of victimhood is both delusional and we're seeing increasingly very dangerous, linked to the idea of toxic hate speech that should be snuffed out at all costs. So the universities, in one sense, they have some splaining to do. I don't, you know, it's a little strong to say they have blood on their hands, but if I were reckless, I would say that.
Charlie Kirk's murder is really just one link, I think, in a whole pattern. Well, actually, you suggest this in your article, too, that it's just one link in a whole pattern of leftist violence in recent years, from Antifa rioting to the George Floyd riots, the destruction of historic monuments, assaults on conservative speakers on campus. All of that seems to stem from this notion that it's justifiable, that violence is justifiable against any perceived threats to their worldview, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, that just, it's tantrums. One would like to dismiss this as just pathetic adolescent acting out, except that it is very, very cataclysmic for the safety of others and for the sanctity of public order and property. But it's remarkable. Now, again, we've had, one thinks of, and for your question again about cultural Marxism, I would say that other historical precedents for this is obviously the anarchists of the early 20th century, futurism that celebrated violence, but the anarchists who also believed that they had the entitlement to go out and assassinate people. And I've, right after Kirk's murder, I was thinking, well, which type of assassination does this Kirk assassination fall into? There's assassinations that have changed the world, that have changed history, and the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand that set off World War I is quintessentially that. There's other assassinations that haven't really done much, and the assassination of President McKinley. it felt initially like the Kirk assassination was going to be in the first category, but I'll be damned if I don't watch, you know, the narrative shifting already in the LA Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. The narrative now is all about Trump's fascism. So it may not, you know, some of us felt like there will be some justice if this unites a ignites a conservative revolution. I'm not so certain about that. But in any case, those early 20th century anarchists, some of them were Marxist for sure. Others, I think, were just in a completely another fantastical self-engrossed ideology of violence for its own sake and radical anarchy, radical anti-statism. So that was something very real. The 60s with the Weathermen and the 60s revolutionaries, that was pretty bad too. I think probably there were many more bombings than we've experienced now, but the widespread riots, and again, there were very, very widespread riots, but it is I think it's a left-wing phenomenon. Now there's data, if you take into account like the Oklahoma City bombing that had a lot of casualties, the received wisdom has always been, well, the right-wing violence is much more, has had much more consequences than left-wing. But that's based on a handful of very high casualty incidents, which isn't to say that those deaths are not also important. But I think in terms of sheer number of incidents, it's very hard to make the case that there's anything comparable between idiotic right-wing attacks or threats on politicians and the routine violence the left feels entitled to engage in if it doesn't like, if it thinks that there's been a bad police shooting, or, you know, that's sort of the pretext of choice in recent years based on completely phony stats and usually completely lies about the episode that is said to be a bad shooting.
You totally anticipated a question that I was going to ask you, so I'm just going to jump to that. I wrote recently that I don't believe the left is going to de-escalate the violence after Charlie's assassination. They've already demonstrated that they're not repelled by his murder. Right. I don't believe they're going to police themselves. I think we're actually going to see an intensification of left-wing revolutionary violence, like the so-called days of rage of the late 60s and early 70s, which you just mentioned, when bombings and assassinations of cops were pretty commonplace. Do you feel the same way, that we're headed into a new days of rage?
Yes, I think it's quite possible. You know, what we've learned about our fellow Americans in this moment is quite extraordinary. We were told after the hagiography, after the beatification of Luigi Mangione, the assassination of Brian Thompson, the healthcare executive, and there again, one looks on in astonishment as the narrative goes from how is it that somebody feels entitled to assassinate to, oh, well, you know, there's all these inequities in a for-profit healthcare system. That's really what the issue is. But we were told that these were just the people that turned Mangione into a cult hero and a target of teen love, like the monkeys or something, you know. This is just the fringe. We haven't seen that. The people that are celebrating Kirk's assassination is not just the fringe. And I completely agree with you. Somehow it does feel like it's not getting enough pushback, and there's a copycat aspect to this, and the rhetoric just has not changed sufficiently. Now, I don't know, you know, I think it's kind of facile or naive to say, oh, we all have to dial down the rhetoric, because we believe our rhetoric, they believe their rhetoric, and we've discovered there's almost no common ground in America now. I don't know what we share, but yes, I mean, we're speaking today, there was a shooting of ICE officers, an attempted shooting of ICE officers. It does not seem to be slowing down.
Yeah, I also wrote about that, about the fact that right and left, to generalize, in this country just have absolutely no common ground on any single issue you can name.
Right.
And that I think, you know, to borrow from that tagline of the movie Highlander, there can be only one, because matter cannot exist with antimatter. And I think that's what we're facing in this country is there's just nowhere to go except, except the, you know, a possibly violent clash. What does it, you know, when you look at the sadistic celebration of many people on the left about Charlie Kirk's death, what does that tell you about the degree to which this ideology has come to dominate the Democrat Party?
Yeah, I heard only once right after the assassination. I tuned into the Young Turks podcast, which is a left-wing podcast, and the head of it, and I'm not going to pronounce his name correctly, Cenk Uygur, it looks like.
Yeah, right.
He was sincerely shaken by this, and by and large avoided the usual contextualization. Well, but of course, you know, he said this and that, and just said, no, this is completely unacceptable. This is absolutely horrifying. I didn't hear so many more of those, really. And I completely agree. I mean, one is always counseled when it feels like, how can we go forward? How could there be greater divisions if we can't agree that men can't have babies, that, you know, the quality of our current environment is not, is, whether there's white privilege everywhere or black privilege, what do we agree on? And yet one is always counseled to go back to the Civil War period, where there was so profound a division. Of course, that's not exactly a reassuring precedent, is it?
Yeah.
and I have to say, in my, it's tempting in kind of a just irresponsible juvenile way to say, yeah, bring it on. Like, where do you go from here? Take up arms. Now that's crazy. I'm right now listening to Audible, Gone with the Wind, which is one of the great novels of all time, and certainly one of the great anti-war novels, which I don't think is really acknowledged. And it's quite daring and feels dangerous to read something so much from the loser's perspective. And certainly her views on race are totally unacceptable today. Nevertheless, it's a very persuasive worldview in some of its aspects, and she is absolutely unflinching in describing the devastation of war in a way that Americans have completely forgotten about. It has to be avoided at all costs. As I say, I think there's people who are tempted to say, "Yeah, let's do this, guys," but I think we have to avoid that. But I don't know what you do. And the idea of peaceful succession, it was easier in a sense in the Civil War because you had geographical contiguity. Here you really don't. So I don't have an answer. I think about this all the time, Mark. What do you think? I mean, where do you think this goes next? And what are our options here?
Well, I struggle with that myself. I mean, I spoke recently at a Freedom Center retreat and that happened shortly after Charlie's death. And we, of course, that was all anyone talked about, just about. And I mentioned that without calling for violent retribution or revenge, which I know Charlie himself would not have called for, the right needs to have some open conversations about how we can end this civil war. We didn't start it. We didn't want it. But we, I think, had better be damn well prepared to end it because the future of this country depends on it. The nation cannot sustain itself going on this way. So I don't have an answer myself yet, but I think the right has to take a long, hard look at ways that we can justly and righteously and effectively end this burgeoning civil war. So I wish I had a quick answer to that, but I think the right does have to get serious about the magnitude of the seriousness of what we're facing and come up with some answers and take action.
Yeah, I agree. Now, that raises then the question about how far do you push the limits? And I'm uncomfortable with some of Trump's more loose, spontaneous language. And we saw this sort of the Stephen Miller approach of shut the left down completely. I don't want and I don't want us to go after hate speech. I don't want us to start going after speech, which was the disastrous gesture of Pam Bondi, the attorney general, right after this, saying there's a difference between free speech and hate speech, and she was going to target those who engage in hate speech, cross the boundary. Yeah. She said that was a complete mistake. She's just parroting the left, and it will solidify the precedent that will be used against us even more aggressively when the Democrats retake the White House, which they will at some point. So if they're going to go after NGOs and the whole funding mechanism, they've got to do it within the boundaries of what government is allowed to do in the private sector. That we are fighting to preserve civilization, and civilization depends on respect for the rule of law and due process, and not the dictatorial use of force.
I totally agree. I don't think that the right should start saying, well, now it's your turn, or now it's our turn.
Right.
We're in power, and now it's our turn.
Exactly.
And you're going to reap the whirlwind.
Yep.
We need to avoid that. Just to bring things back to the roots of all this, the university, the politicization of the university's mission over the last several decades means that far too often today, higher education, and in fact, lower education too at this point, all the way down to preschool, it's not opening minds and teaching critical thinking or passing down the grand legacy of the Western tradition. It's subverting all that. It's telling students what to think and churning out totalitarian zealots who believe that their family members, their neighbors, anyone outside their bubble of tolerance and inclusion are existential threats to democracy. In fact, my colleague at the Freedom Center, Daniel Greenfield, has written that we need to begin treating college campuses like terrorist training camps that need to be de-radicalized, like Germany was denazified. Do you think that's a little too hyperbolic, or what can we do about the toxicity of left-wing indoctrination in education?
Yeah, ideally you would start new institutions. You would just walk away, but that's very hard to do. These are expensive. Yeah. And of course, most parents send their children to college not because they care about education. Well, they have two. If you're sort of in the elite, you care about the credentializing, you care about the bragging rights at cocktail parties that your child is going to Amherst or Bowdoin or, Smith or Yale. And of course, you also care about getting him into Goldman Sachs. I think other parents that aren't in that cloying, claustrophobic realm of high elite, high power, high status wealth are just interested in college's vocational education and believe it's a rung up to the middle class. And they don't really care about the education either, let's be honest. Now, I'm going to take issue with one of your phrases when you said that politicized. Yes. They don't teach critical thinking. I avoid the term critical thinking because I've heard it too much coming out of the left. That is their thing.
Oh,
it is the
yes.
ed school thing. Critical thinking, which basically means we teach you how to deconstruct television ads to understand how capitalism is trying to seduce you into a state of prone acceptance of grotesque, wealth inequalities or something. I think that education is about content. It's about knowledge. It's about cramming as much content knowledge of literature, architecture, history, the periodic table, the Krebs cycle into students' empty noggins as possible in a mere 4 years. And we should have, of course, they should have known much more but in K through 12, but that's also a disaster. So I think conservatives have taken the easy route recently and talked about school simply as kind of a debating society in a place where you should be able to hear all sorts of viewpoints. That's way too current events focused as far as I'm concerned. I think people should be learning German and Latin and not debating, not hearing both sides of the trans issue, because there's time enough for that once they graduate. And that's not the special advantage of schools, is being up to date on whether Trump is a fascist or whether the trans identity should be celebrated and whatnot. Their comparative advantage should be Renaissance pastoral poetry and understanding the spread of civilization across the Mediterranean. Nevertheless, I like the idea of the terror training camps. I'll push back a little bit, which is in my recent times when I go to colleges, you can find just incredibly impressive students. They're disproportionately male, but not exclusively. There's some very impressive females I've met. I don't really give a damn whether there's females or not. But in some of the more selective schools I've been at, there's these core groups of very serious young men who are pretty damn educated. So there, I can't tell. I'm not that familiar with the actual range of the curriculum. Here and there, there may be little pockets still of real teaching about the Renaissance and the Middle Ages. But that's probably a little bit optimistic, because I think that so many faculty in so many fields now have absorbed the philosopher, French philosopher Paul Ricoeur, called the hermeneutics of suspicion, which is that you approach texts as adversaries, and you approach them with the assumption that they are trying to put something over on you, and they need to be deconstructed to show the power plays underneath them. That's pretty pervasive. So I don't know. I mean, we need the grand tour. We need to have people just be sent to Europe with tutors the way they did in the 18th century from Britain, to go and actually go to the Uffizi galleries in Florence, experience Botticelli close up, and get them out of the universities. I don't know. It's such a massive problem, Mark. The resources are so great. The prestige of these universities is so great. And I don't know. I guess if you send your child to one, you should be monitoring his reading list, making sure that he is taking courses that at least on paper look like they're going to teach the classics, and make sure that he stays away from all of the obvious sources of mind pollution, which is all of the victimology studies.
Yeah. Heather, not to put any pressure on you, but it's been a couple of years since your last book, When Race Trumps Merit. Dare I ask if you have another one in the works?
Well, there's going to be a paperback edition coming out of When Race Trumps Merit in April. And then I am putting together a collection of my music writing, classical music.
Excellent.
And art.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Well, keep an eye out for that. Heather, how can people best keep up with what you are writing and thinking?
Well, thank you for asking, Mark. I do have a Twitter feed, and I'm so on social media, I'm not even sure what the handle is, but if you were to Google Heather MacDonald in Twitter or X, you'd get there. And that serves mostly to post things that I've written or podcasts like this that I do. So that's probably the best way, or they can, the Manhattan Institute has a homepage for me, and I don't know how comprehensive it is, but that's another way.
And I love reading you on City Journal. That's another place that I could send people.
Right, but that's, if you want to get the articles, that's more reliable to just check the Twitter feed, because they get posted there.
Good point. So. Good to know. Listeners, I urge you to check out everything Heather MacDonald writes, because it's well worth it. You will not regret it, and you can thank me later. Heather, thanks for joining us again at The Right Take, and keep up the great work.
Very stimulating, challenging conversation, Mark. Thank you so much. I'm going to have to go back and figure out how to answer your questions now that I'm off the air.
All right, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.